AM950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Welcome into the Friday edition of FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Well, today's show is focused all on what's happening at the state legislature, as we're going to be talking about the latest news of what's happening in the special session with the Capitol reporter from Minnesota Lawyer and friend of the show, Kevin Featherly. Coming up, we'll also be speaking with someone who wants to serve in the state legislature. So we're definitely going to be hitting up the local and state part of politics here on today's version of FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Now, one thing that's certainly been on lawmakers' minds is how to make sure we have affordable housing for people amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Already, even before the pandemic, it was almost impossible to afford an apartment, let alone a house in the Twin Cities and the entire state of Minnesota. But we could have at least a little bit of relief on the way, but nowhere near enough. I want to turn things over to Mike Moen of Minnesota News Connection, who has more on this story.
Minnesotans struggling financially during the pandemic will see some more relief in trying to make their housing payments. The governor has announced a new round of assistance, and a key group hopes more long-term fixes are approved. Earlier this week, Governor Tim Walz said that $100 million from the Federal CARES Act will be distributed to those in need of housing assistance, so long as they meet certain requirements. Ann Mavity of the Minnesota Housing Partnership says it's the exact amount they were requesting in emergency aid, but she says the work shouldn't stop there.
We had a crisis before COVID happened, and we are continuing to have one.
Mavity hopes state lawmakers will include affordable housing funding in a bonding bill currently being negotiated by legislative leaders. She says the money could help jumpstart construction on several thousand units that are simply waiting for the necessary funding. Both Walz and Mavity cited concerns over extra federal unemployment benefits that are due to expire at the end of July. Mavity says that could create a tidal wave of people not being able to make rent. She adds that more spikes in coronavirus cases will cause additional economic harm as well.
If we need to close down again, all those folks that do not have a way to make a living will need support or they lose housing.
She says that's why the $100 million will likely be used fairly quickly and that getting to work on additional solutions could lessen the impact of more renters and homeowners falling behind on their payments. Mike Moen, Minnesota News Connection.
So there is at least a little bit of help coming at the state level, but overall, not anywhere near enough. But at the local level, there could be some good news, especially if you happen to be a resident of the city of St. Paul. As last week, the St. Paul City Council unanimously passed five new renter protections. Now, the new law, which takes place on March 21st of 2021, is going to deliver five new protections, capping security deposits at just 1 month's rent, limiting tenant screening criteria, forbidding landlords from terminating leases without just cause, requiring landlords of affordable housing units to give advance notice of sale, and requiring landlords to distribute a packet outlining tenants' rights and responsibilities. The law does not prevent landlords from evicting tenants who break the terms of their leases. Now, coming up next week, I'll hopefully have much more detail on what was passed in St. Paul with an interview, because these are some really sweeping protections that were passed, and some of these, including the provision that prohibits landlords from terminating a lease without just cause, is actually a first in the state. But these really are necessary, though, because rent in St. Paul has increased more than 15% adjusted for inflation since the year 2000, while wages, as you can imagine, they've pretty much stayed the same, according to a study by the Minnesota Housing Partnership. Meanwhile, people of color are much more likely to be renters, with 83% of black households in St. Paul renting, compared to just 41% of white households. So, like I said, hopefully we'll have much more on this next week. All right, coming up next, we are going to be speaking with someone who wants to defeat Mary Kiffmeyer in this fall state Senate election in District 30. Yeah, that's the Mary Kiffmeyer who loves voter restrictions. was a member of the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, and, oh yeah, is someone who was caught making racist statements in public on Facebook. So certainly someone that could use replacing in the state legislature. And we'll be speaking with Diane Wynn, who is running against Mary Kiffmeyer this fall. That's coming up next here on FYI Politics.
And we're back on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Well, one of the candidates running for state senate in the district that is currently occupied by State Senator Mary Kiffmeyer, who has quite the controversial background over the years, is Diane Wynn, who is running in Senate District 30, which represents portions of the Northwest Metro, including St. Michael and Elk River and Rogers and kind of that area. As Diane joins us now on the show. Hey, Diane, how are you doing today?
Good. Thank you, Brett. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, so tell us a little bit about your background and why you decided to get towards running this year.
Well, I wasn't going to be on the ballot, but nobody put their name on it, and I thought I'd step up. I didn't want her going unopposed, and I put my name on the ballot right at the end there on the last day, and I thought it was a time for change, especially what's going on in Minnesota. So that's why, and I'm a licensed Minnesota real estate agent and a licensed insurance agent. And I thought I just, with my past experience, my life experience, that I would be a great candidate and the new Minnesota State Senator for District 30.
And, of course, you are running against Mary Kiffmeyer, who has been in that seat for a number of years in District 30, who has a very controversial past when it comes to trying to restrict voting rights. And also, unfortunately, on race relations as well, being a very divisive person. In fact, just a few weeks ago, I remember talking about this on my show, how she got into a Facebook exchange with an admitted racist, where when she was talking about what black people want, as she said the goal of the protests following the George Floyd tragedy was because they want $13 trillion $375,000 for each black. That was her exact quote on a Facebook page, and she was even responding to what looked like admitted racists, which is just unbelievable, Diane. It's certainly not the type of person we should really be having serving the legislature.
I totally agree, Brett. That's why I believe Mary Kiffmeyer should be disqualified with these comments, and it does not belong in our Senate. She should withdraw from this campaign race and contribute to ending systemic racism in Minnesota instead of peddling in it. And what she said is totally dehumanizing, and she needs to drop out, do her duty, and change.
And talking about your background as well, you, of course, are an Asian American, and you've experienced racism, I'm guessing, kind of firsthand in your life as well.
Yes, as an Asian American, I know what racism looks like, and I know what it feels like. And I am for social justice reform, and we need to ensure that the George Floyd tragedy never happens again.
So talking more about that, what sorts of reforms do you think we need in the state legislature when it comes to these types of issues with social justice?
Sure. With the reform, I do believe that we do need our police. I don't believe that the defunding the police department should happen. We need them. They have their badge. They are here to serve and protect. But I believe that the 911 calls should be screened. If it's post-traumatic, mental health, domestic abuse, there should be a specialist, a therapist that goes with them and dispatches with them to help them de-escalate the issue. I myself, like I said, I am a licensed real estate agent, a licensed insurance agent, and with that comes code of ethics and continual education. I believe that the police department needs continual education, continual anger management, or just de-escalation, deep breathing therapy, so that this doesn't happen again.
We're speaking with Diane Wynn. She is running in Senate District 30, which represents portions of the Northwest Metro, including St. Michael, Elk River, and Rogers, kind of up in that area once you're along I-94. And you, of course, are running against Mary Kiffmeyer, who is the incumbent Republican. And I followed her career for a number of years, and there's no other way of putting it other than that. Well, she's a former Secretary of State, and there's basically been no voter restrictions that she doesn't like, which is a big deal because we are obviously in a pandemic right now, Diane, which is going to make it tougher for some people to vote who are very nervous about going and voting in person. What are your thoughts about how we should be voting this fall in terms of a vote by mail? I know on your website you told this interesting story about how you have a town in your district, I believe Munson Township, which has only 1,500 people, but everyone gets a mailed-in ballot every year, and they've been doing that for years because they don't have their own polling place. Tell us more about that.
Yes, my opponent, Senator Kiffmeyer, she believes in voter suppression. She believes that all illegal voters will be voting if this had happened. But I ask how. These are mailed official ballots, absentee ballots, that are mailed to eligible registered voters. And eligible voters can also get absentee ballot applications. So there's nothing illegal about it. It's all legal in the state of Minnesota. And she is the chairperson for this on the committee to stop the vote by mail ballots. And I just find that it's just another way of inequality. It's another way of voter suppression, and it needs to stop. She needs to be stopped.
And let's talk about some other issues that are big in your district, because you're kind of in a booming area of town in that Northwest Metro area along I-94, where we have lots of growing communities. And right now in the state legislature, we're still trying to debate what we should do with a bonding bill. And as I'm sure you can talk about, a bonding bill would have a lot of big impacts on your area up near Elk River and St. Michael, being, well, that you have lots of infrastructure needs and lots of other things that would really help out your community through a potential bonding bill.
Yes, Brett, I totally agree. We need to rebuild, and we need to get our economy moving again. The bonding bill is a great stimulus, and it needs to be passed and not used as political leverage. There needs a lot to be done. Our jobs need to be saved. So it does not need to be used as political leverage. Like what is happening now, it needs to be passed. And there's a lot of infrastructure, buildings, and bonding that needs to be done for not only jobs, infrastructure, but also our schools.
So let's talk more about schools right now, because what we're debating right now is, well, how do we send our kids back to school? Should we even send them back in the first place, or should we continue distance learning? That's been the debate right now. That's been going on not only at the state legislature, but also at the national level. What are your thoughts on how we can safely educate our kids this fall?
Well, I don't know what it's going to look like. We'll know at the end here of the month, I believe July 27th. But I do know that we need to provide our schools with tools and the funding to succeed during COVID. Whatever it may look like, the three options that they have in place, we just need to keep our teachers and our children safe and on track for school. We need to make sure they have all the right equipment, all the shields, the scanning temperature scans, because if one staff or one teacher gets infected, it can spread, and there just needs to be a protocol to probably shut down the whole school. So whatever it looks like, we need to make sure that it is safe for our teachers and our children.
We're speaking with Diane Wynn. She is running in Senate District 30, which represents portions of the Northwest Metro area where her opponent is Republican Mary Kiffmeyer. Her website, by the way, for Diane is dianeforsenate.com. Very easy to get to. So as I know, campaigning certainly has been challenging amid the pandemic. At least when you've had a chance to talk to people, whether maybe in person or via Zoom or online through social media or whatever else, what kind of issues are people telling you about that they find most important this fall?
Definitely their jobs, job security, what's going to happen with school, healthcare, and if there's going to be funding, and how do we get that funding if the bonding bill does not get passed. And so if you believe what I believe in, please go to my website, dianeforstatesenate.com, and help me reach my public subsidy goal and get Kiffmeyer out of the Senate and be part of hashtag Foot Minnesota Senate.
And that's a big deal you were just talking about right there, because you do need enough donors to be able to qualify for those subsidies from the state, which is a big deal when you're going to be running against a very entrenched Republican senator, or really any political person who's been entrenched for a while, to be able to get those matching funds. So I think it's important to point out that even if you don't live in the Elk River, Rogers, St. Michael area, those matching funds are a big deal to someone running in that district. So give us that website one more time.
DianeForStateSenate.com.
Couple more final questions for you here, Diane. Any other big issues you'd like to highlight that, well, if you get elected to the state senate, that you would really be making a top priority for?
Well, as a working family, I'm going to work and vote for the working family, our labor unions, and I'm going to get things done. I'm not going to, whether if you're on the right, I love fishing, so if you're fishing on the right side of the lake or the left side of the lake, or if you're fishing with a blue lure or red lure, I will cast my vote and get it done. Whatever's right for my district, believe in me, I will get it done and get it passed.
And finally, talk about some of the endorsements you've received thus far in the race.
Yes, I've been endorsed by the DFL, MAPE, and also the Minneapolis Building, Construction, and Trade Council, which is a great honor, and Planned Parenthood. They've helped me. They believed in me, even being a first-time candidate, that I can win and I can get Mary Kiffmeyer out of Senate and along with her racism.
Well, Diane, really wish you the best of luck this fall. Yeah, it would certainly be good to get someone other than Mary Kiffmeyer in that district. We've been speaking with Diane Wynn. She is running in Senate District 30 against Mary Kiffmeyer. Again, SD30 is portions of the Northwest Metro area, and her website is DianeForStateSenate.com. That's DianeForStateSenate.com. Really appreciate the time today, Diane Wynn, and best of luck in the race this fall.
Thank you, Brett. Thank you, AM950. Thank you. God bless and stay safe, everybody.
And stick around. We'll come on back and have more on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. AM950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. You're back on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Joined now by our Capitol reporter, Kevin Featherly, who is with Minn Lawyer, MinnLawyer.com, who reports on what's happening at the state capitol, and with another special session that is taking place as we speak. Figure we better check in with Kevin and figure out what's taking place over in the legislature. Kevin, hey, thanks for joining us again on the show.
Thank you.
So lots of topics to talk about. I want to dive into, well, the legislature possibly trying to strip Governor Tim Walz of his emergency powers. We'll also be talking about the bonding bill, police reform, and the Senate Lawlessness Oversight Committee, which I believe is the non-technical term, where they're talking about what happened in the third precinct and statues being torn down, among other things. So let's start off talking about this measure that's going through the legislature, that was going through the legislature, that was going to strip Governor Tim Walz of his emergency powers. Here's the question I have for you as I was reading through here, Kevin. So, as I saw, the House voted 70-63 on a measure that would have suspended the rules and allowed a vote on the emergency powers. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because it sounded like it wasn't necessarily a party line vote on that measure.
Yeah, I didn't look to see who crossed over, but that's clearly true because the votes don't add up. It wasn't a strict party line vote. But yes, you're indeed correct, and you're singing my song because now we're talking about the arcane aspects of legislative politics that are ever so interesting. They were indeed voting on to suspend the rules in order to take up a resolution that had already been approved by the Senate that would have stripped the governor's powers. But yes, they were only voting on a motion to suspend the rules. And so they spent 4.5 hours arguing over that.
Wow, so 4.5 hours on this. And I take it this was pretty riveting, lively debate that you were hearing?
Indeed. And unfortunately, we were robbed of the opportunity for a couple of hours additional debate when they would have debated and voted on the actual resolution. That never happened, unfortunately.
What were some of the arguments that we were hearing, especially from the Republican side, since they're the ones who are mainly in favor of stripping Governor Walz of his power? What were they trying to use to persuade people to get on board with them?
Well, the essential point is the one that Senator Gazelka made Monday morning, sort of in the opening salvo, the press conference that he held in the Capitol in person on Monday morning. And his line, which was picked up by the House, was the emergency is over. There's a little bit of cognitive dissonance for me because he said, yes, we have a pandemic, but we no longer have an emergency. And that is essentially what they were saying. And I think where what they're angling toward, and I actually think at some point this could happen, is they're trying to get to a place where they can negotiate a way for the legislature to have greater involvement in COVID-19 decisions so that it isn't strictly on the governor. And that's not an unreasonable position because there are constitutional issues in play here. But the way they're getting there is, you know, arguing this kind of weird point that, yes, we're in a pandemic, but we're no longer in an emergency. And to sustain that argument, they occasionally wandered into fairly absurd territory. I'm afraid I would have to put it that way. For instance, and these are pretty smart people, you know? And so it was a little surprising to hear some of what I heard. For instance, Tony Albright arguing that masks are ineffective against the COVID virus because the COVID-19 microbe is 0.1 microns, whereas the, you know, drywall dust is significantly larger. And so what good is the mask? Well, the science suggests that no microbe ever passes through a mask as sort of a naked standalone entity. Every COVID-19 microbe is attached to a water droplet or to, you know, some kind of aerosol. And that's where it becomes larger and doesn't just, you know, escape through. And plus there are other factors such as, you know, sort of electrostatic effects that attract that moisture, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So it was kind of strange. It was kind of strange, some of the arguments that you heard, and that's just a representative one. I don't really particularly mean to pick on Representative Albright, but there were a number of arguments like that made over the course of those 4 hours.
Well, I don't think you're wrong at all. As I was looking, watching along on your Twitter feed, as you were saying, I mean, you were fact-checking these. You weren't just using your own opinion saying, oh, well, that's not accurate information. I mean, you were fact-checking as we went along, and there were blatantly false statements that were made about this, which I don't know strategically if that was the best play for the Republicans. As you said, they might be making a better argument by saying, hey, we just want a place at the table. But it sounds like they were putting almost more emphasis on some of these types of conspiracy theories, for lack of a better way of putting it, in terms of why they need to remove Walz's emergency powers.
Right. And there was a point in time where Representative Ann New spoke factually, but stop short of the information that she had in front of her. She said that the CDC data suggests that COVID-19, if you combine the COVID-19, the flu and pneumonia infections all together, put those numbers together, then that falls below pandemic levels. Those three diseases on top of one another means we don't have a pandemic, which is true, but she omitted from the statement that she read that once you get to a point where you process death certificates from the most recent weeks, that's likely to go up. And so then it wouldn't be. But the point is, we don't have a COVID-19 flu and pneumonia pandemic. We have a COVID-19 pandemic. And that very same page that she pointed to come to that conclusion shows that on its own, we are well within the pandemic range of infections, and we are likely to have an uptick as death certificates and other numbers come in over the most recent weeks. So, yeah, I guess it's easy to be critical of it, put it that way.
We're speaking with Kevin Featherly. He is the Capitol reporter for Minnesota Lawyer, MinnLawyer.com. And, well, let's move on to another dog and pony show that was taking place at the state legislature. That's at least me giving that opinion. And that would be moving along to the state Senate, where they were having what's called the, informally called, the Lawlessness Oversight Committee, where they were talking about things that happened in the aftermath of what occurred with the George Floyd murder, where we were having the third precinct being burned down, among other places around town. Also talking about statues that were being removed. And this went on for quite some time, it sounds like, Kevin, over several days. And as we were talking about off air, it seemed like a lot of political posturing was happening with this committee.
I think that's fair to say. I think that to some degree that's fair to say of both sides. However, the Republicans were in control, and Senator Scott Newman, who was in charge of that committee, for some reason, he's the transportation chair, and it's a little, I mean, his committee does have jurisdiction over the budget of the State Patrol and over Capitol Security, so it meshes there a bit, but one would have thought that this would have been a Judiciary Public Safety Committee issue, and that therefore Senator Limmer would have been in charge, but he was on the committee, but played a pretty minor role. It was really Scott Newman's show, and he controlled the debate. He decided what would be discussed and what would not be discussed, and he was pretty strict about emphasizing lawlessness, rioting, criminal activity. The Democrats continually tried to push the conversation into another direction to talk about what happened to George Floyd, why he died, the police tactics that led to it, and that then led to the aftermath. But he insistently said that that's not the subject of these committee hearings, and so we're not going to talk about that. Yesterday's hearing was really pretty fascinating, the most fascinating of all, because the featured speakers in the afternoon, at least, or in the late morning into the afternoon, were three members of the Minneapolis Police Federation, three of the directors and vice president of the union. And they were really, really very, very critical of leadership, both at the city level and the governor's office, the executive branch, really very critical. I mean, I can read a quote here that I found incredibly striking. I'll read it directly. This is from Officer Rich Walker, who is a director of the Federation. He's a frontline cop. He's an officer. This is his quote. "We need help from each and every one of you senators at the Capitol to fight for us, because our city leaders are not, our council is not. The hatred they have towards our department has never been more evident. You see it on the news every night." That was the tenor of that discussion. It was really striking.
Yeah, very striking, it sounds like, coming from the police officers in that case. And I believe they were also talking about the third precinct and how it sounds like the officers were basically given orders to kind of stand down in this case and, well, let the precinct become overrun. Is that kind of what, was I hearing that right?
Yeah, that's kind of the way they were discussing it. But there's a little bit of dissonance there, too, because a previous hearing where they interviewed, you know, they brought to the testifiers table Commissioner Harrington from the Department of Public Safety and the Adjutant General of the National Guard, John Jensen, suggested that they really didn't begin to emphasize a multi-jurisdictional, meaning, you know, departments from all over the state, bringing those together, bringing the State Patrol and the DNR, the local police departments, and the National Guard until after the third precinct fell. And yet, the officers yesterday insisted that those forces were already arrayed, but they were ordered to stand down, that they were dispatched to different areas, and they were never ordered in. They said that those forces could have helped save the precinct, and they also said it could have been done without a loss of life. I don't know how to, you know, bring those two stories together, and I frankly don't know who's right, but, you know, the Adjutant General said that he did not plan to bring any more than 200 MPs into the Twin Cities at all. It was only when things got very serious that he decided that he would bring 700 troops in who were trained to deal with civil disturbances, and it was only when things really got out of hand. And I think this was really after the fall of the precinct, and as things got hairy into Friday morning, that they scrambled to bring in 7,000 National Guardsmen, which was the largest deployment of National Guard troops in the history of the state.
Over the past few days, who else were they bringing in to testify before this committee, and any major highlights that we think we should know about in terms of what happened before this committee?
Well, I know that Colonel Langer from the State Patrol appeared several times, as did Commissioner Harrington. Yesterday, in a portion of the hearing I didn't really pay too much attention to because I was writing, Margaret Anderson Kelleher, who's the transportation commissioner, was brought in. And I think they were talking about marches on the freeway and overtaking the bridge and that kind of stuff. Probably the most significant figure is the one who didn't show up, because there was supposed to be a hearing today, and it would have been their final, I guess, sort of showcase hearing. They had invited Mayor Fry from Minneapolis to testify, and I think he might have been the lone witness, but he apparently declined to participate.
So, and maybe you're not the person to answer this question. In fact, you're probably not, but ultimately, what was kind of the aim of this committee? What were they trying to do? Was it just highlighting what was happening with the so-called lawlessness, or were they proposing any new state laws that would curb what was happening? I'm just sitting here overall trying to figure out, what were they hoping to accomplish with this committee?
As to legislation, I know of no legislation that was suggested, but that doesn't mean that legislation might not be produced by these kinds of things. This is a little bit like an investigatory hearing in the Congress. I think it was fashioned that way, and it was brought forward that way. But I can tell you that three of the main figures, three of the people who are on the committee, it was a big committee. It included the entire Transportation Committee, the entire Judiciary Committee from the Senate, those two committees combined. But three of the main figures there were Sheriff Bill Engelbrechtser. He's a senator. Sheriff Ingebrigtsen, Dave Senjum from Rochester, and the chair, Senator Newman. And coincidentally or not, these are the same three guys who called for the federal government, called for Attorney General Barr to step in with a Department of Justice investigation of the Minneapolis Police Department just a couple of days before these hearings commenced, before even this committee was announced.
And coming up next on the other side of the break, we'll continue my conversation with Kevin, as we'll be talking about police reform and the bonding bill. And we're back for the final segment of FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. I want to get back to my conversation with the Capitol reporter from Minnesota Lawyer, that's Kevin Featherly, as coming up in this section of the interview, we are going to be talking about the bonding bill and police reform, two more hot topics at the state legislature. Let's get back into it. I want to move on to a couple more topics before we have to wrap things up today, and one that looks like it has some bipartisan agreement is a potential bonding bill, as it looks like the leadership from both the House and the Senate have come to an agreement on what looks to be about a $1.3 billion bonding bill. But what's key is that it's only the leadership of the Minnesota House with the DFL and the leadership of the Republican Senate, which of course has a Republican majority. But what's key, of course, is that in both caucuses, or in both houses, you need 60% support, which means you do need the minority party, that would be the Republicans in the House and the DFL in the Senate, to come on board. And thus far, it looks like House Republicans, for the most part, are not on board with this bonding bill.
No, I think it's pretty clear that the bonding bill is in trouble. And I'm not exactly sure, because I wasn't privy to the negotiations, but I do know that they did something rather unusual in that they combined the bonding bill, which of course needs the 3/5 majority, as you mentioned, to pass, with a tax bill, with tax cuts. That would have been largely to bring Minnesota's law into conformance with the federal bill that passed a couple of years ago on capital equipment purchases. Speaker Hortman said that was a good idea. She signed on to it because she thought that would help for instance, businesses rebuild after the fires and riots in Minneapolis. So they squished them together, which makes for the odd situation where a tax bill now has to have a 3/5 majority. Normally that's not the case, but it would have to because it's part of this bill. But as you say, House Republicans really have made it very clear, in particularly in the Ways and Means Committee on Tuesday, that they are not on board. Representative Greg Davids called it a garbage bill. Garofalo said that we're not voting for it because you continue to refuse to negotiate with us. Now, what didn't come up in that discussion was this whole business about the governor's executive powers. That was never brought up. Greg Davids mentioned the single subject clause as an objectionable thing. Representative Joskowski said it would create a situation where taxpayers could be buying homes for people because of a particular amendment that was added. They never mentioned the governor's authority, yet I really kind of suspect that, as Kurt Dowd said earlier in the regular session, he wouldn't support a bonding bill until you got rid of the governor's executive authority. So I think that remains the backdrop, even if unstated.
Yeah, I would kind of side with you there, too, because, yeah, for the most part, the Republican senators are on board. It's just the House members that of the Republicans that are not on board with this thing. So, yeah, I wonder if they would be in favor of this bill if they got rid of or at least amended the emergency powers of Governor Wall. So, like a lot of things in the legislature, it's yet another negotiating ploy is kind of what I'm reading through.
And important to note, too, that Senator Gazelka said that he's got the Democratic votes in the Senate because, likewise, the Senate needs 3/5, and so they need to bring in some Democrats. But he's confident that they have those votes.
And final topic before we wrap things up here, Kevin, let's talk about where things are at with police reform in both the House and the Senate. As we mentioned a little bit earlier, the Senate has mainly been focusing on the lawlessness, as they say, that's been occurring throughout the state. But have we been seeing much debate on what's been happening with police reform? Obviously, we had some hope in the legislature that that might happen in the last legislative last special session, but of course nothing really came through with that. Are we any closer to some sort of agreement on police reforms?
I'm interested in the way you framed that question, because you said, are we seeing any debate? The answer to that question is no. We're not seeing much of anything, because it's all being done, frankly, in secret. But the other part of your question is, are we seeing any progress? I think the answer to the question there is yes. Senator Gazelka told us on Monday that I think his quote was, he sees real progress. And it's interesting because as of the end of last week, before the special session started to get some buzz about the negotiations. And we found out, for instance, that the business partnership, a big group of very large businesses that's headed by the Uber insider Charlie Weaver, who was at one point, I believe, Tim Pawlenty's chief of staff and was a longtime senator. That group is headed by him. A lot of juice, a lot of influence. And when they weighed in saying they want to see police reforms, my sources tell me that sort of jump-started the conversation, that things got very serious at that point. Chair Mariani had said that for the first time, a counteroffer that the House had offered in the first special session finally got a response at the end of last week. And then when we saw the folks gathered together on Monday, Senator Gazelka is saying that he thinks that there's progress. So there are areas of agreement that we already knew about. We knew both sides favored a chokehold ban. We knew that both sides favor a duty to intervene. So if a cop sees somebody really laying it on, a citizen, stop it, intervene. There are mental health and autism response training. There's use of force language rewrite that both sides want. There's differences in the language there. For instance, different parts of statute where the rewrite of the use of force language might show up. It might show up in this statute or this statute. They got to figure all that out. But areas of agreement. But what I thought was very interesting that Senator Gazelka said is that they're continuing the conversations. And this is the quote. The rest of it's on the table and we're talking through them. Many of those things I think we can do. You never get 100%. I'm hoping we can get 75% or 80% of the two sides. That would, to me, would be a win. I don't know precisely what it means, but the House reforms are really quite sweeping. There were, I think, 22 to 24 measures, whereas the Senate had five bills, break them down, roughly 11 different measures. So it sort of sounds like the Senate is moving somewhat in the direction of the Democrats, including a few more things. Gizelka actually said that, but he also wouldn't tell us what precisely he was talking about, what areas there might be.
Yeah.
Another thing that I think is interesting here, if you don't mind me just adding this, there was agreement to omit some important Democratic priorities. In the first special session, the Senate came forward, said, we're not accepting the Attorney General as the authority in all deadly force police prosecutions. We're not going to give him original jurisdiction. The Democrats in the House wanted that, and the County Attorneys Association agreed to it. But the Senate said no. The Senate also said no to a restore the vote for felons proposal, which is a little bit askance for the rest of what's being attempted here. It's kind of a side issue, but they did include it. Those things were off the table. Speaker Hortman told us in a press conference on Monday that what was off the table today is off, or was off the table in the first special session, remains off the table. And yet, in the Ways and Means Committee, the House did pass the identical bill from the first special session, which means that those items are in the bill that's going forward for negotiation. I don't know that that means that they're going to survive. I don't even think it means that it's going to kill the bill because of a bad faith effort. I think it's really just a bargaining chip. But it seems like a slightly risky play. But they're doing it. They're putting them all in there.
Yeah, and that was actually right along the lines of where I was going to kind of go with that last question. So glad you were able to, kind of get us up to speed on what's happening there. But going back to my original question, didn't even mean to make that distinction between what we're seeing in debate versus, well, what they could be negotiating behind closed doors. That's an interesting aspect because, as you said, it sounds like most of what they're kind of negotiating is going on behind closed doors.
Yeah, that's sort of been a running theme for the last few years, and it's well, with the COVID-19 issue, of course, a lot of hearings have been on Zoom and a lot of discussions have been behind the scenes to a degree that's becoming a little uncomfortable for those of us who cover this stuff.
Yeah, it makes it a little bit tough to follow what's going on, whether you're a member of the public or someone who's with the press like yourself. Yeah, that's certainly not the best scenario.
Right. And I mean, the former point is the more important one, because if we can't see it, then the public can't see it.
Right. Hey, we've been speaking with Kevin Featherly. He is the Capitol reporter for Minnesota Lawyer over at MINNlawyer.com. Also, make sure you give him a follow on Twitter. Kevin, I'm totally blanking on your Twitter handle. What is that again?
It's my name. That's why I can't remember it. It's at Kevin Featherly.
Oh, man, that's terrible. I couldn't even remember your Twitter handle was your actual name. I think that's a sign I got to wrap up the interview if I can't even remember that. Kevin, as always,
that's okay.
Kevin, as always, appreciate the time today.
Very good. Thank you.
And I am just about out of time. Stay tuned. We got Matt McNeil coming up next on AM 950.